Well, on this evening's show, we've got a whole mass of interesting material to work our way through on the subject of rhesus negative bloodlines in humans, or at least nominally so. I'm joined by a lady who's been on the show before some time ago now, and unfortunately it was one of those shows that disappeared in the mists of time, so I never got a chance to podcast it. But Jill was with us talking a bit about the education system in which she worked for a very long time, and about living life as a young Romany, I think, and how education was managed there. But tonight we're dealing with something very different, because Jill has the rhesus negative blood, as does her mother and her daughter. And thanks a lot for joining us, Jill.
You're welcome.
It does seem to me to be a bit of a mystery, this. I've had a look at some questions and answers on the internet, basically to see what ladies today are finding out when they're pregnant and they discover that they're rhesus negative. And many of them seem to be a bit confused about the advice they're being given. And I must admit, the advice seems to be confused as well. So how did you first discover that you were rhesus negative?
Well, hello, Dr. Rock. Hold the microphone. I can't remember a time when I didn't know I was rhesus negative. And that's because my mother is rhesus negative. She had a very difficult time in pregnancy and lost two babies. Obviously, she didn't lose me because I'm the same blood group. But I knew from a very young age that I was rhesus negative because she told me, and we share that blood group.
And of course, it was in the early days of transfusion, wasn't it? As the result of a loss of people that were being transfused, that they first discovered the rhesus.
Yes, as far as I'm aware, it was when they did blood transfusions in America during the Second World War. It was the first time really that they were able to do that. It was the first time that the medical profession were able to do blood transfusions and operate in that way on soldiers returning from Europe who were wounded. And they discovered that even though the operations went absolutely well, and there shouldn't have been any reason at all while that particular person should have problems, a lot of these soldiers died, had seizures, and they had all sorts of complications. And the common factor was that the rhesus negative people were being given blood transfusions with the rhesus positive blood, and they were dying as a result of that.
And that's really where the connection is with you and your mum and your two predecessors, isn't it? Because presumably the earlier babies were rhesus positive, were they?
Yeah, the first baby was rhesus positive, and the baby actually was stillborn. My mother's body produced antibodies which attacked the rhesus positive baby in the womb, because if you're a rhesus negative mother, if you're carrying a rhesus positive child, your body would assume that that's somehow an alien invader of some kind. It doesn't recognize that to be part of you. It sees that as being an invasion from another species, almost. So the antibodies are built up, and in my mother's case, the antibodies killed her first child, and it was stillborn. Then I came along and I was fine because we have the same blood group. The third baby was also rhesus positive, and at that time they were experimenting with various drugs which my mother was given. She was in the hospital for many, many, many months in her third pregnancy and given a concoction of drugs. The baby survived, but when it was born it was deformed. And my father had to choose between his wife or a deformed baby. So he chose his wife, and the third baby died as a result.
It seems to be the case that where both parents are rhesus negative, you can be sure you will get a rhesus negative child, which means that these problems don't arise, because it's a problem of the mixing of the rhesus positive and the rhesus negative blood, I gather. It's a bit like having an organ transfusion from somebody with a different blood type, is that, yeah? And so rhesus negative children with two rhesus negative parents, there's not a problem. But it turns out that even two rhesus positive people can turn out a rhesus negative, where the problem arises, but that's because the baby's got the different blood type. And one rhesus positive and one rhesus negative can turn out either a negative or a positive child. And the problem comes when you get a rhesus positive baby in a rhesus negative woman. Is that the... Yeah, and so, I mean, your mum was obviously in the very early stages of this concoction of drugs. Have they reached any other conclusions by the time you had your kids?
I've got one daughter, and she's actually rhesus negative. The interesting thing that happened to me, my daughter's 35, so it's a long time ago now, but I was told at the antenatal clinic that I was rhesus negative, which I already knew, and because I was rhesus negative, I had to go to the hospital very frequently to have blood tests to see whether there was any chemical reaction at all in my blood. And my first comment was, well, why don't you test the blood group of my husband? Because if he's positive, then you would know that there may be a problem. But if he is negative, then all this testing is there's no reason for it, because obviously the two negatives make a negative and there's no problem. However, the reply was that you don't test the husband's blood, you just monitor the mother's blood and look for the chemical reaction, which would occur if the unborn child has the rhesus positive blood group.
Yeah. Now, this is one of the things that I think we're certainly going to get into later, is Big Pharma's actual interest in this, because they do seem to be keen to make money out of it. And I think that's one of the first important points that I noticed, was that irrespective of what, because they don't test the other half's blood group, as it were, that means that irrespective of whether there's no chance, and there is no chance when there's two rhesus negative parents and a rhesus negative baby, there's no chance of any problems. And despite that, everybody gets to go through these same tests and this same monitoring. Like you say, does that still happen very regularly?
I'm not sure what they do now, but certainly when I was pregnant in the 70s, my blood was tested on a weekly basis, weekly trips to the hospital to have my blood taken from my left arm and then my right arm to be tested to check for chemical reactions. Because there wasn't any chemical reactions, it was assumed that the baby I was carrying was rhesus negative, and of course she was. Again, they at birth, they take blood from the placenta just to double check that there's no kind of cross reaction between mother and baby in terms of rhesus negative mothers. If at that stage they've made a mistake and there is a rhesus positive baby there, you then get a shot of something called anti-D, which is an anti-antigen drug that stops the mother building up antibodies that would harm future pregnancies.
Yeah, which is where it gets even more interesting, in my opinion, because this is an in utero inoculation, effectively. So you're inoculating the baby whilst it's still in the womb, and I think it nowadays happens at 26 weeks and... But yeah, I think they're recommending a couple of these things. And it's something I'd definitely like to look at a little later in some detail, because, of course, as most of the people listening are aware, vaccines are a problem anyway, even to children once they're born. But this one is not dissimilar from the rest, really, but there's some very interesting comments to be made on that. There are some pretty distinctive traits, aren't there? There's very distinct physical traits to the rhesus negative people. What would you say are the ones that struck you most when you started looking into it?
Well, I obviously have got an interest in rhesus negative as a blood group, because there's only 15% of the total population of the planet who are rhesus negative, and that's a very small group. I was told from a very young age that it was a rare blood group, and years ago we carried around with us a little green card that said we were rhesus negative. So there's always been that fascination of why only 15% of the total population, and why is it a rare blood group?
According to the information that I saw, it's 15% of places like the UK and America, but actually 5% of the world population as a whole. But that's, of course, because a whole load of the population doesn't have it at all. It's peculiar to white people and originally from Western Europe. Is that right?
Well, according to my research, the highest proportion of people with the rhesus negative blood are actually the Basques on the top of the Pyrenees mountains between Spain and France. And they're a unique people that quite an ancient European culture. Other than the Basques, the biggest group is the Celtic people. And then the third biggest group are people that were termed Oriental Jews, which are Jews which never left Palestine. So there's the Jewish race who've got the rhesus negative, the Basques, the Celts, and there is also a fairly high percentage amongst the Berbers of North Africa.
Yeah, I read that 40% of the Basques have got the rhesus negative, and the other 60% seem to have some related thing that isn't quite it. The Berbers, Gaul and Aquitaine, too. And as well as though the Jews that didn't leave Palestine, I gather that a lot of the Palestinians are themselves rhesus negative. And what interested me was I found out recently that the Japanese Ainu, who are a really ancient Japanese Caucasian tribe of some sort that were hunted more or less to extinction, are also almost all rhesus negative, apparently. So we seem to have interesting little clusters of it spread fairly well across the world. Do you make anything of that?
There's a lot of theories out there, and the more you find out, the more questions you have. I mean, the characteristics that seem to be common are reddish hair, blue or green eyes, and extra vertebrae. Light sensitivity, and generally a kind of a empathic or sensitive or ESP tendencies seems to be associated with the rhesus negative, whether they're sort of Europeans or North Africans. So that's interesting.
Yeah, there's several things in there that quite struck me. One of them is the increased sensitivity to sunlight, because I've met a few rhesus negatives now who tell me that's the case, and it's related, isn't it, to melanin imbalances and vitamin D deficiencies. Have you come across that? That's one of the things that I read. The thing is, this information comes from so many different places. We'll play some tunes a bit later, and I'll post some links into the chat boxes for people. But I was struck a couple of the times by the fact that increased sensitivity to sunlight was mentioned in some of the more casual and anecdotal kind of stories. But when you start looking into the science behind it, you do find that there's imbalances in the melanin. Both melanin and vitamin D, of course, are associated with sunlight. I think that melanin is related to melatonin, and that's to do with light sensitivity and access to darkness and all manner of things. So these do seem to be physiological rather than just opinions or feelings. The extra vertebrae as well. I noticed that sometimes it says an extra vertebrae and sometimes it says an extra rib. Have you noticed that?
Not really. I mean, my main research seemed to suggest that rhesus negatives, for some reason, seem to be long in the back compared to their leg length. So that's the extra vertebrae sort of thing, which seems to be quite common. And again, some of my family are Irish, of Irish ancestry, and that's quite common there, where they've got sort of a long back and sort of compared to their leg length, which is interesting. It's just an interesting sort of thing that keeps coming up, really.
One of the things I only came across today when I was preparing for the show, and actually I must admit I've come across a whole load of new, because you know how we noticed that it seemed to be pretty dispersed and it was quite hard to find stuff over the last few years. I found quite a lot of material today, but one of the things that I read a couple of times was that the extra vertebrae, that all human embryos have a tail for a while, when they're really small. And that one of the differences between the rhesus negative and the rest of the blood groups is that this extra vertebrae is actually the remnants of a tail. And apparently, although the two places I was reading admitted that they'd never seen it, they'd also read a lot around the place that you're born with tails. Is that true?
I've got no evidence or knowledge of anybody being born with a tail. That's really, really, really unusual. It's just crazy. There's a lot of stuff out there about rhesus negative, and some of it is just really, really far-fetched. But there are some things which are interesting, but sometimes people really go off on a complete tangent. It is quite common, however, for rhesus negative babies to be born yellow with jaundice. That's quite common. Yeah. I do know that.
I was quite interested by the reddish tint to the hair as well, because I know we've had discussions as to whether the rhesus negative is actually itself a mutation, or whether the rhesus negative is the original thing from which everything else mutates, because there's a bit of a discussion around this. And of course, the red hair thing is turning out to be a bit of a major subject in terms of looking into the more ancient types of people that have lived on the earth. Neanderthal, I think, is now generally recognized to have a reddish tint to its hair, and maybe to be generally red-haired. And I know that the original inhabitants of Easter Island as well are recognisable by the fact that they've got an auburn tint to their hair. So it's quite interesting, I think, that the rhesus negative people should be like that as well. I was a bit struck by the blue, green or hazel eyes, because I wasn't sure that there were many other colours than blue, green or hazel. What about the fact that the blood's copper based? Is that right?
This is news to me, because I didn't really know that until quite recently, but I found out that from information that the rhesus negative blood is copper based rather than iron based, and that's quite fascinating, because how can that be? Whenever you ask medical people, if I ask my GP or the nurse or somebody in the medical profession, they seem not to want to answer those sort of questions. They seem to sort of feel uncomfortable and change the subject or not really want to give you any information.
That also, I think, is quite interesting, because one of the things that struck me, we used to suffer from extremely acid water in the place that we were living before we came here. And one of the things it does is it eats away the bottoms of copper pipes where it sits around on them, and it turns the copper blue. If you look at the bottom of the pipe where it's worn thin, you know that copper, when it's out in oxygen, it goes that kind of green, that verdigris green colour. Well, it seems that when it mixes with water or gets water sitting on it, it turns blue. And I was wondering if the copper-based blood might be the origin of the blue blood.
You want to go with that?
No, she's recoiling from the microphone on that. It is an interesting thing. We'll be looking a little bit at some of the, as Jill says, there is a lot of bizarre stuff out there. And one of the things I'm hoping to do in this show is to try and filter the bizarre from the real, so that we get a bit of perspective on it. But one of the theories is, no, it's gone in completely. You'll have to wait for that one to come back again. This happens occasionally. There's a whole load of characteristics which I feel are kind of a bit sort of connected with the new age and the kind of age in which we're living, including the fact that it's suggested that that rhesus negative people share a general and fairly intense feeling of not belonging, and that they have a marked sense of mission and tend to be truth seekers. What do you think about any of those?
In my experience, that's true. But then I don't want to exclude people that are rhesus positive that also feel that way as well. Again, research suggests here that a lot of our our leaders and a lot of people that have inspired us seem to be from that blood group. You know, the royal family, rhesus negative. Lots of the American presidents were rhesus negative. You know, the Turin Shroud. Some people believe that the Turin Shroud is the burial cloth of Jesus. Some people believe that it's a medieval fake. At the end of the day, the blood is rhesus negative.
Which in itself is either a fluke or deliberate, isn't it? And the Turin Shroud is a genuinely, whatever else it is a pretty mysterious thing. I know that for as many people as there are debunking it, there's just been so much work done on it. In terms of people, as I was wandering through this, I found, as you say, a lot of American presidents, and the list is a lot longer than this, but I came up with Eisenhower, JFK, interestingly, who turned out obviously to be a bit of a numb choice for them, Nixon, Clinton, and George W. Bush Sr. Obama also, yeah, is rhesus negative. I gather as far as our lot are concerned, Prince Charles, the current Queen, Prince William, Lady Di, I was told, and old times Ramesses was rhesus negative, so it was around in Egyptian times, and as I say, we'll be looking a bit at the supposed history of it. Mick Jagger, of course. In the writings, I was particularly struck, of course, by Sitchin von Daniken and Robert Anton Wilson, all of them as well. So, and I have also seen suggestions that it was possibly rhesus negative that were, because of this kind of tendency to be a bit creative, whether they were responsible for the cave paintings that sprung up. Because, again, they were in the kind of regions where rhesus negative people were. What about empathy? Do you find particular empathy with rhesus negatives more common?
It's difficult, really, because talking about my experience and my family's experience, my daughter's experience, there is an empathy, I think, with rhesus negative types. And I know my daughter has a rhesus positive husband. She is not sure whether she's going to, for example, have a family or not. But the thing that bothers her most is, what does she do with a rhesus positive baby when she would rather have a rhesus negative one?
Yes, indeed. And it's really a bit of a random throw, that, isn't it? Because it could go either way. So you've got people say that you're sort of more psychic and intuitive, sensitive vision as well, as you said. Here's an interesting one I came across, an ability to disrupt electrical devices. Okay. Yeah.
That's another thing which you've noticed, that people with rhesus negative blood, for some reason, build up an enormous amount of static, and you can spark people and things and disrupt electrical items in your house. That's something which I do, my mother does, my daughter does, other members of the family that have got this blood group do. So there is that kind of static energy stuff, which is most peculiar. And the other thing is that it would be interesting if we could sort of find out how many people out there that are empaths or have got an interest in ESP or have got a gift in terms of knowing about things, having a sense of knowing about things maybe before they happen. How many of those people have got rhesus negative blood? That would be interesting.
Yes, I think you're right there, and that kind of ties in along with the red-haired thing is particularly interesting to me because a character that I became interested in some several years ago now called Stan Gooch was originally a well-established academic psychologist who was teaching other young psychologists. I think it was psychologists. Certainly in that realm, the realm of the mind, he was working. And he was a well-attested and well-appreciated man until he started looking specifically into the history of Neanderthals. And he did a lot of very scholarly books on the subject with footnotes and citations and all the proper work that people expected. But as is the case with many people who've gone rogue or renegade, he was effectively sidelined from the moment he started looking into this subject. And in the end, I think he died of cancer. I think he died basically like so many of these people in a caravan with no money and no respect from anybody really. But the last book he wrote was called The Neanderthal Legacy, and what he did with it was he was a man of spirit and he decided he was going to write a story that people could read and without all the citations, because they could always go to the earlier books. And one of the things he pointed out was that the Neanderthals appear to have been red-haired, and that he also think that they were mostly left-handed, that they tended to live at night, and that they were maybe moon worshippers rather than sun worshippers. So there's all sorts of really quite unique distinctions he was gathering between them and modern humans, as it were. And the psychic and intuitive part of things wasn't something he looked into particularly, but he was interested in physical manifestations of Neanderthal, and he'd sort of come to the conclusion that as well as the red hair and the left-handedness, that there was every chance that some of these individuals would have second toes that were bigger than their big toes. And he set about trying to do a load of research into this and was apparently, you know, kind of brought to a halt almost all the way along the line. And the same thing was true of any students that he managed to get enthused in this sort of thing, that they too were prevented from doing this. And I'm wondering, I think you're right, it would be very interesting to see, because their experiments in telepathy and psi and things have been performed. Although I don't know about you, I've found that they're nearly always discounted as not relevant. Have you seen, it's almost like experiments on telepathy generally are not being taken seriously.
I think that's a problem. We live in a society really where you know, science is something where it has a theory and then it looks for evidence and then it's either proved or it's disproved. And if it's not a concrete, thing that they can sort of quantify in some way, then it is disregarded. And we're talking about things which aren't measured in that kind of way. So it's a difficult one really.
Yeah. What about prone to alien abductions? Do you think they're prone to alien abductions?
I don't know of anybody with Reese's negative blood group that I know who have been abducted by aliens in any shape or form. No, that is, again, it's just one of those crazy things. It's there's just so much stuff out there, and a lot of it is really ludicrous. And this is basically a small group of people, 15% of the population of the planet, who just want a few answers, and all we're getting is craziness, really.
It's also true that whereas our blood groups used to be available from our GP, and whereas you used to be given, well, people used to be given a green card to identify them and make it clear what was going on, this is no longer the case, is it?
Yeah, that's interesting. When I was born, my mother was given a green card saying that I was rhesus negative. And my mother has a green card even now that says she is rhesus negative. My daughter I know is rhesus negative, but she didn't have a green card. I asked the hospital when she was born, where is the green card? And they said, oh no, we don't do that anymore, because we can test blood immediately and get a result, so we don't need to give anybody a card, because should you need a blood transfusion, we would give you negative blood anyway, because negative blood doesn't harm positives. It's only the other way around that there's a problem. And then the testing is so fast that we would know within whatever, how long it takes, that you were either rhesus positive or negative. So because of that, there's no reason for anybody to know.
Sounds a bit unlikely that they just give you negative blood automatically on the basis that it doesn't harm positives, because presumably there's not too much negative blood around in the blood bank relative to the positive. Did you ever give blood?
I've never given blood. I've never given blood, actually, but the conversation I had with the nurse and the doctor many years ago when I was in hospital recovering from childbirth was that there is no reason to give anybody a card, because people automatically will have negative blood until the blood test shows otherwise.
Right, sorry, I was just typing in the chat box there as well. So some other physiological things that I've seen is that that there's a tendency towards lower body temperature and higher blood pressure. There we go. See, again, we're finding very different stuff.
High body temperature, I don't think so. No idea of that. Low blood pressure.
High blood pressure and lower body temperature.
Low body temperature.
Yeah, lower body temperature. Yeah.
I don't know about lower body temperature, but I mean, I've got sort of low blood pressure rather than high blood pressure.
Yeah, indeed. And what about being immune to the AIDS virus? Did you come across that anywhere?
I had no idea that was actually a factor of rhesus negative. That's fascinating. I did know that I'm immune to smallpox and other kind of pox type and viruses, because that the hospital discovered that when I was younger, because I was the only person who wasn't infected. In fact, I was a carrier who was infecting other people, it would seem. But I didn't know that the HIV virus was something which also I was immune to. That's fascinating.
And is that common amongst you? Have you found other people immune to smallpox and the like?
Because it's such a small group of people, you talk about 15% of the total. The only people that I would come into contact with that I know are rhesus negative are probably family members. So it's not something that you identify with a blood group in your kind of local area, really.
This strikes me as one of the things that was particularly striking when I started looking into this. I mean, I think there's slightly more dense information out there now, but in nearly all the subjects that I've chosen to look into, either because I've been interested for a long time or become interested, there is a sort of nexus of information on the internet where you can go and find a small group of websites which will give you an enormous amount of stuff. And the impression I'm getting on the rhesus negative stuff is that it is disparate, that it hasn't for some reason managed to pull itself together. I wonder if there's any chance of I wonder if anybody is actually trying to reach beyond their families and find out the wider experience.
I think the problem we're going to have today, in today's world, is that if you wanted to reach out beyond your family and find other people's experience, it's going to be difficult when anybody that's under the age of 40 may not even know they're rhesus negative.
And that's because blood group information, which used to be stored at the GP, is no longer stored there. It does seem that there's an attempt to make something less obvious now than it was being made, you know, maybe in earlier and more innocent times. Have you come across any other examples of that?
I mean, my daughter is rhesus negative. I know that because I told her. Because I found that out at birth, because I wasn't given an anti-D shot. However, she went to her GP recently to ask him to confirm whether she was rhesus positive or rhesus negative. And the GP said to her that they no longer hold that information at GP surgeries.
This is really one of the reasons why, as soon as you mentioned this to me, I became instantly interested in it, because it does seem to me that there's something of considerable fascination here. I was actually given another person to talk to about this, who realised that soldiers are, of course, given their blood type. It's on their dog tags, apparently. Certainly American soldiers are. I don't know about ours. And in his time, he spent a lot of his time apparently going to the places where with the army where rhesus negative populations were particularly enhanced. But I did try to get in touch with him for the show and didn't manage it. Perhaps I'll be able to get a chat with him at some other point. I'm going to just play a couple of tunes while we grab ourselves a glass of water and stuff, and we'll be back with you probably 10 minutes or so. Yeah. No, I know I am. I know I'm standard blood bank. Hiya folks, you're listening live to Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com and scottysovereignsontheland.ning.com. And I'm talking with Jill tonight about the somewhat cryptic subject of rhesus negative blood. We've had a bit of a discussion whilst the music was playing about the overall statistics. It seems to be that the official line is that there's about 15% of certain Caucasian populations, the ones that are mentioned in the UK and the US, are Rh negative, and about 5% of the world's population in all. But of course, if they're not testing a lot of the men and nobody really knows what their blood groups are, we've got no idea how many of you there are, have we really?
Well, the interesting thing is that if people are no longer told whether their rhesus is negative or not, and only women find out when they are pregnant, and not all women have babies, so again, those that don't have babies won't know that their rhesus is negative, and they don't test men, so men won't know their rhesus is negative unless they're in the armed forces. If people don't know their rhesus is negative, how do they get these statistics?
That's a very good question, and not one that I can really answer, so I shall change the subject. So that I know that both of us have come across some interesting information regarding local Jewish populations and with regard to rhesus negative. What did you find out?
Again, doing my research on where rhesus negative comes from, wondering where my family tree comes from, I guess, because obviously there's got to be a path, a rhesus negative path that goes back in time. And one of the things I found out was that what used to be termed the Oriental Jews, they're the Jewish people that stayed in Palestine and did not leave Palestine, have got a higher percentage of rhesus negative in their population. Now that's interesting because if you go back in time with the Hebrew, the Jewish people, and you look at the Bible and you look at the documents that were written sort of thousands and thousands of years ago, the suggestion was that they shouldn't mix their blood. And I find that interesting, that going back to a time when we didn't have hospitals and we didn't know about blood groups and we didn't know that even that there was a rhesus negative, they were told many, 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 many thousands of years ago to keep their blood pure.
And there were quite a lot of Jews that stayed behind in Palestine. It was quite a substantial population, wasn't it? And you're right, it is an interesting thing for them to be considering. Not for the first time I find myself wondering whether people didn't know about this maybe a lot further ago. I also came across some interesting information on a population of... they're called Ashkenazi Jews. I can't remember where they are. There's a population of something like 8 million of them. And apparently they can trace their kind of racial line back to four women, and those four women were themselves unrelated, and apparently the genetic history of these particular Jewish women was apparently completely different from their menfolk. And again, that's another really bizarre fact, a bit like the fact that the Basques, who are another Rh negative heavy people, have got a language that isn't related to any of the related on Earth. It's not an Indo-European language, and it's not what any of the others. The not mixing of the blood thing as well takes me right back to where my original interest in blood came from, which is from the biblical stories and the stories from ancient Egypt about the fact that the pharaohs and the patriarchs and the other senior figures in these texts appeared to need to marry either their sister or their half-sister. I don't know whether you've come across that.
I haven't come across that in particular, but I do know that a lot of the pharaohs were rhesus negative. And Ramesses has got red hair. So you've got a mummified pharaoh in a museum with red hair who is rhesus negative. Now, that is strange because you don't associate ancient Egypt with red-haired people. So I find that, again, is an interesting quirk, really.
Yeah, yes, indeed. And the origins of the thing seem to be completely shrouded in mystery as well. And also, it's one of the things that makes it particularly complicated, because people seem to kind of combine several different theories all together. Do you have any theories? Where do you reckon your blood came from?
Oh, this is very difficult, because every time you look at anything about Rhesus negative and why it exists and why it exists in certain areas on the planet, you just throw up more and more and more questions. Sometimes I feel that the Rhesus negative blood was the original prototype, and it's the positive blood that's the mutation. That's the evolutionary jump. And our blood's perhaps the older version. And sometimes I'm happy to go along those lines. And sometimes I think, well, what if there is some kind of off-world activity that's been manipulating our genetic code? I was listening to a chap called Dr. Peterson, who is a famous American scientist, used to work for the American government, now doesn't, because he's saying things that they don't like. And he actually suggested that in the States, there are 15% of the American population, according to this renowned scientist, that have alien DNA. Now, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yes, I wanted to look a little bit further into that and find out, because I heard that clip when you sent it to me. It is, of course, something that comes up quite a lot. I think that Zachariah Sitchin, now apparently discredited, although I don't necessarily believe all of these discreditings, he also was writing about the fact that there's whole sections of something like 220 genes in the human DNA that are recognized as being in there, but not having arrived as a result of, they weren't in any of the earlier primates. And the idea is that they might have been slipped in sideways from bacteria, although there are no bacteria that apparently match up with the genes. So, it's, I guess, another reason why I'm interested in this, is because these stories of origins, I think, are deeply related to where we find ourselves now. I find it really quite uncanny that we're looking at a blood type which is apparently based on a different metal from everybody else's blood types, that it can reasonably be connected with the idea of blue blood because of the copper and water thing. And that so many of our kind of stars and royal bloodlines and all the rest of it are actually of this blood type. I can't help feeling that the situation that we're in now is in some way connected with the actual origins of all of this stuff. Of course, one theory suggests that the Anunnaki, who are reputed to be an alien race that came to Earth maybe 450,000 years ago, were capable of doing genetic manipulation, and that they were responsible for this. I don't know whether you think that's possible. You have any thoughts on that? Because I know you've looked at the Anunnaki a bit, haven't you?
Again, I guess anything is possible. If you look at the ancient Sumeria, there is evidence in the ancient artifacts that there was some presence from off world doing some sort of experiments. I mean, that is actually a fact. It's actually in the artifacts and in the carvings and in a lot of the records from ancient Sumeria. So anything is possible. What I find strange is that if that is so, if there was a kind of an off-world kind of intervention thousands of years ago, how come they're not here? How come, you know, we've got very flaky evidence, and how come, you know, they've never returned? Unless they have and we haven't noticed, I don't know.
They're all good questions, and ones that I've asked myself is, you know, if they were here all that time ago, why aren't they here now and stuff? And of course, there's many people who'd say that they are, and that I think is one of the more bizarre connections that people are, I guess, bound to make. We're always looking for further extensions to the Anunnaki story, and I know that there's an extension of that as well in the idea that you might be all reptilian alien hybrids, but that's true of all of us as well. I think we get more into a kind of maybe slightly more realistic realms when we start talking about Cro-Magnon, because they were known to have the rhesus negative gene, weren't they?
Can I just step back a little bit now to Anunnaki? I'm sorry about this, but just what makes more sense to me isn't an alien kind of, I don't know, spaceship landing thousands of years ago. What makes more sense to me is that perhaps something crash landed here some thousands of years ago, and perhaps the rhesus negative strain is a genetic stamp that's been woven into people that were here already. I can go with a crash landing, and maybe survivors might have mingled in with whatever beings were here originally. That makes more sense to me than a kind of a genetic manipulation. But I'll just pass you back to Nick.
No, that's interesting, that, because in the Anunnaki myth, I mean, the first thing that most people read is Zachariah Sitchin, and then most of what you get to read after that, people like Alan Alford, Gods of the New Millennium, many of the others certainly are, they're not exactly clones of Sitchin, but they're sharing the same information, and that is the idea that that a race deliberately came here, guided themselves here, landed, set up experimental outposts, had several hundred entities that kind of flew around the planet, flew around Earth, and that they could go backwards and forwards on occasion from here to wherever it was they came from. Always, as you say, a little bit difficult to swallow, I think, because all we've got is kind of artistic hints and evidence. We haven't got, as far as we know, of course, any kind of craft or any sort of physical evidence, although there's a lot of writings on the Sumerian tablets which seem to suggest that they, well, it seemed quite clearly to suggest that they had some kind of cloning technology. And although we've seen all manner of evidence of really advanced stone-cutting technology and all that kind of stuff, we really don't have any of that stuff to hand. All we can do, a bit like with the quantum experiments, is assume that it happened because we can see a bit of the evidence. I always much preferred with you the Christian and Joy O'Brien approach, which is that somebody or something ended up here, basically, and had to make the best of what it could do. And probably in biblical times, you might have had extremely extended lifespans, which slowly but surely kind of either shortened because you're kind of interbreeding, or shortened because these beings would have had to attune themselves to the cycles of the planet on which they found themselves. I noticed in the chat box that Sven's put that the ancient tales talk of creator god, which he finds more plausible than alien intervention. So creator god is, of course, one of the things that is another of the explanations, is that the rhesus negative bloodline was created by God in the form of Adam and Eve. And I think that actually Sven's put earlier in the chat box as well, Anunnaki and Elohim have much in common with Adam and Eve and their descendants. And that, of course, is another of the ideas, isn't it? Is that Adam and Eve were somehow rhesus negative. And of course, from them came the Israelites.
Yeah. And you're back to the ancient sort of, Hebrew stories again that you find in the Bible and in the Hebrew scriptures that go back in time to a creation myth or creation theory. All I can say again is that these people were and have a tendency to be rhesus negative, which is interesting when they represent such a tiny, tiny small part of the global population.
And yet they're spread well amongst them. So if we have a look again at the idea that I think it's been shown now that the Rh negative gene had arrived by the time Cro-Magnon arrived, and of course their spread, I think, was through France and Spain and North Africa, so they were fairly limited. And they were fairly recent as well compared with Neanderthal. Neanderthal is another potential parent of the rhesus negative gene. They know that they were present in Neanderthal, and they spread a lot wider, didn't they? They actually spread right the way over through the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea and into Israel and the rest. And they had the red hair as well.
Again, and then you have to ask yourself, well, okay, if that is true, then how do these two things link up?
Well, we now know that they can link up with modern humans in the fact that I think that there was a lot, when Stan Gooch was writing, there was a lot of resistance to the idea that Neanderthal and modern humans could interbreed, could actually not only produce babies, but produce babies which were themselves fertile, because the idea is that Neanderthal and humans are distinctly different. Well, I think it's now been, I think they've now got as hard evidence as far as we can have any hard evidence from genetics, because I'm not sure how well it all works anyway, but that 1 to 4% of the DNA of modern people, again outside Africa, is the result of interbreeding between Neanderthal and modern humans. So I think that's probably where the idea comes from, that the rhesus negative gene came from them and into us. Another idea is that it's simply a random evolutionary mutation, which of course, if it's a whole different, I'm interested that you haven't come across the fact that it's copper-based rather than iron-based. I think that's something that would be really well worth looking into, because if it is copper-based rather than iron-based, then the chances of a random mutation are pretty slim, really, because that's a major change to have been making.
I don't believe this is a random mutation because of the copper-based blood. I don't believe that is possible. It's too big a leap. And if it's a random mutation, why is it Basques in the top of the Pyrenees and Jewish people in Palestine and Celts that are wandering across northern Europe into Britain, or it just, why those groups of people in those areas? It doesn't make sense to me. I can't see how that would happen just in those areas to those groups of people and not other groups of people.
One way or the other, it is affecting many, many women and their children now in the modern world. And it seems that obviously there'd probably be a fair amount of trouble without any kind of intervention, because women would be losing a lot of babies, and also under certain circumstances the mother would be becoming sick as well. And infertile, so the result is stillborn children and infertile women. But I'd like to just take a quick break because I'm being interrupted here, but then I want to come back and have a quick look at the shot that Big Pharma appears to be, as far as I can see, actually recommending to everybody that's discovered to have Rh negative blood and is looking to have a baby. And once again, I think we get to see there the kind of the sort of program that we're used to seeing, which is a bunch of deliberate interventions which aren't necessarily needed. For the rude interruption there, we're back with you live on tnsradio.com and scottishsovereignsontheland.ning.com, talking about rhesus negative blood, and specifically I want to talk a little bit about the vaccine, that's the single vaccine that's being offered to women and the circumstances under which it's being offered. Before we get on to that, last week I was talking about a series of massive structures that were built all the way around the earth on a great circle from Easter Island back to Easter Island, running through sacred sites in Giza and Peru and Cambodia and India and Pakistan and Burma, I think it was, a huge engineering project that was executed over right the way around the globe and over thousands and thousands of years. The oldest of the things, nominally about 3,200 years, they built on a much more ancient site itself, and the most modern of them about 1400 AD, I think it was built. And somehow this scheme has been pushed forward through time. Just in looking at some of the buildings and some of the artifacts that have been created even along that line, let alone elsewhere on Earth, it is quite clear and undeniable that some of these ancient races, especially the people that built the city committed to Ramesses in Egypt, appear to have had access to something remarkably resembling CNC technology, i.e. they had the ability to sculpt giant, perfectly symmetrical statues out of really hard rocks like granite, and they could do it using just flat circular geometry. and even creating the utterly symmetrical statue would be a problem to us nowadays. I've also been fortunate enough recently to speak to an engineer who's been to the Great Pyramid at Giza and who's seen the so-called sarcophagus in the so-called King's Chamber, and he said that he agrees with the opinions he'd read previously on the internet that whatever it was that was used to drill the inside of the sarcophagus out was a drill that was moving faster through that particular rock than any drill we could make nowadays, and that also the outside of the sarcophagus bears the markings of a saw of similar capabilities, i.e. you can see from where the saw cuts are that the saw was cutting incredibly fast through this incredibly hard stone. Now, we would find it really difficult just to mimic those two particular operations, but there are thousands more, thousands and thousands of examples of impeccably cut and dressed stone, flat stone, stone with perfectly evenly spaced identical holes down a little narrow slot, stones that had been cut with mortise and tenons so that they could be slipped one inside the other to make a single homogeneous wall that would resist almost all kinds of physical attack. All of this stuff was quite clearly available to somebody, and yet we have no evidence of the machinery that did it, even though in theory it should outlast human bodies and wood and textiles and all the many other things that we rely on. There is absolutely no evidence anywhere, as far as I'm aware, of any of the machinery that could do this kind of work, and yet it was quite clearly being done. And some of the texts from ancient times describe in remarkable detail things like genetic manipulation, genetic creation, and all of that. And we're aware that genetic manipulation is happening now all the time, and not only in the way things are manipulated in hospitals and the like, but in the chemtrails, for example, there's DNA rings which apparently slip seamlessly into our own DNA and modify the way it works. There's genetically modified food. It's not that you have to eat a lot of it, or that over time it kind of builds up and slowly but surely damages you. It would appear to be quite clearly demonstrated now that simply putting these genetically modified items inside the protoplasmic body of the human being changed the nature of the protoplasm. Now, it's my firm belief that the financial system we see, the farming system that we've got, the religious systems that we've adopted, all of them seem to have been running for an awfully, awfully long time. They seem to have been very refined, and that as far back as we can look, right back to Sumer, these sort of things have been going on. And so it's my tendency to believe that the things that are happening to us now today are a direct result of the things that were happening in the dim and distant past. And it seems that there's a pretty determined attempt now to use the rhesus negative thing to generate money for the health service and whatever else it is that it's doing. The basic point for modern women, and the thing that really concerned me when I was looking into this, was really the young people who are getting pregnant nowadays. They don't have necessarily the blood monitoring and all the other things that was going on when Jill had her first child. But basically, there doesn't seem to be a lot of real actual danger. I'll try and post a link into the chat box a little bit later, but I got an article from the Healthy Home Economist, which is entitled Rogam Shot Big Pharma Profit Ploy, which will come as no surprise, I'm sure, to many of the listeners. But it appears for a start off that the only shot available to these people is the Rogam shot. As we heard earlier on, if that both of the parents are rhesus negative, then the child will by definition be rhesus negative, and there isn't a possibility of any difficulty at that point, because it's the mixing of the rhesus positive blood of an infant or an embryo with the rhesus negative blood of the mother, should that occur, which causes the problems. But there is only a very small risk, because under normal circumstances it never occurs. It's only in the event of something like a car accident or a trauma to the mother's belly that some mixing of the blood is possible. Mixing can also occur if there's a miscarriage. Amniocentesis, what they call chorionic villus sampling, CVS. I've no idea what that is. I haven't heard of that. No, neither has Jill. And birth intervention during the labour or birth process. So one of the things that's saying is that there is a minimal danger to your actual woman, as it were, especially with the first baby. But that there they list straight away, miscarriage is obviously something that happens for various reasons, but amniocentesis, this CVS, and other interventions are all capable of actually causing, by puncturing the process, this kind of mixing. So, in a way, some of the diagnoses, and this is something I'm familiar from first-hand experience myself with the NHS, some of the diagnoses that you're likely to get subjected to as a pregnant mother may well end up causing, just through physical reasons, the kind of problem that it's claimed is trying to be avoided. So it's in the unlikely event that mixing occurs, the mother's Rh negative blood would encounter the Rh protein from her positive child and develop antibodies against it, and the process is called sensitization. No harm can come to the baby the first time mixing occurs. If any mixing of blood happens for the second time, however, some of these antibodies from the mother's blood could get into the bloodstream of the fetus and attack the red blood cells, causing Rh disease, which puts the child at risk of stillbirth. Babies born with severe Rh disease require intensive treatment to survive, and I think they're born either blue, or is it blue baby syndrome and jaundice they can get as well?
No, I think
it's blue. Right, it's blue. Yeah. So, basically, the first baby's probably going to be safe anyway, even if it's rhesus positive, because the mother won't start building up antibodies until such blood mixing occurs. There obviously is an increased risk, apparently, as the second and third babies come along, because the mother will continue to build up antibodies, and so there will be a bigger threat. And what is recommended to ameliorate this threat, as it were, is this Rogam anti-D shot, which is in some sense the same kind of inoculation that is given, I believe, for life to people who've had organ transplants into their body, because of course quite often the organ that you're transplanted with comes from somebody of a different blood type, and as a result your body, just like the mother's body with its negative blood and the positive child, will work on rejecting it as an alien invader. Rogam is apparently a vaccine like globulin shot that was developed in the late 1960s to keep Rh negative women from becoming sensitized to the Rh positive blood of the fetus in the unlikely event that blood mixing occurs. Rogam works very much like an immunization, puts a small amount of Rh antibody into the mother's blood to effectively fool it into thinking that the foreign Rh protein has been eliminated. And the Rogam shot does work, but apparently, and this is so often the case, it says that the Rogam shot does work, but only if immunoglobulin is administered within 72 hours of the trauma that caused the blood mixing in the first place. So basically, if this thing is going to work, it's under pretty distinct circumstances, it sounds like. I mean, obviously, it's necessary with all of these things to kind of to do your own research and look into the kind of advice that might be being given, because inevitably the advice itself is going to depend very much on where you live and which health service you're dealing with, and who particularly, of course, you've got as whatever specialist you have, because some people will have personal experience of this, whereas others won't. But by and large, it sounds like if this thing's going to work, then it has to be administered within this 72-hour period of the actual mixing occurring. And how do you know during a 40-week gestation whether or if any blood mixing has occurred, unless there is actually some kind of direct event? And of course, one has to bear in mind that some of these things might actually be caused by diagnostic techniques, which we are encouraged to think are safe. And in fact, I have seen several comments in chat boxes on this subject saying that the Rogam shot is completely safe. But of course, we've seen that about all vaccines, haven't we? And we have one or two doubts about that. So there isn't really any way to tell when the blood mixing occurs, so it makes the Rogam shot pretty arbitrary at 28 weeks gestation and again at 36 weeks with some doctors. So there you go, there's a difference there. And it doesn't make any sense at all. What also makes no sense is that doctors recommend that all Rh negative women get Rogam during pregnancy, even if the father is also Rh negative, as we were talking about earlier. There's absolutely no need for Rh negative women with Rh negative partners to ever get Rogam, as the baby will always also be Rh negative and the risk from Rh antibodies is zero. And yet my definite impression from the one or two young mothers that I've met talking about this is that the Rogam shot is recommended pretty much as soon as they discover that you've got rhesus negative blood. This is leading to some quite interesting research findings. One of the ones I came across was a study group which had a bunch of rhesus negative mothers and rhesus positive mothers, and it was something really bizarre, like 53% of the rhesus negative mothers had in this group had children that had autistic spectrum disorder, attention deficit disorder, hyperactivity disorder, a whole load of neurological things that stemmed up in the children of 53% of these women, whereas these were only problems within 3% of the non-rhesus negative mothers in the group. And one of the things that they're wondering about, well, obviously there's a bit of an argument. This is where the problem really comes in, because there's a bunch of people who are saying, look, in utero vaccination, which I think this one includes mercury, at least it used to, it's easier for the mercury to pass through the various barriers concerned and cause these difficulties. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know anything about this in particular, but I'm astonished that the antenatal clinics in hospitals aren't monitoring a rhesus negative mother at weekly intervals just to check that there's no chemical reaction in her blood, because that to me seems to be the best way to do it. And then if there is a problem with the baby, then they can then be informed to do something about it. But just to have some sort of blanket kind of one size fits all kind of a jab, to me sounds absolutely stupid. I can't see the sense in that at all. Unless it's some kind of cost cutting exercise or something, I don't really know. But in terms of the 53% of rhesus negative mothers who had children that had some kind of special needs problem, I mean, I'm assuming that these babies were rhesus positive babies that had developed these disorders, was it?
I'm not sure that that's the case, because as far as I can get, I'm not sure that a distinction was made between mothers with rhesus positive children that got the shot and mothers with rhesus negative babies who got the shot, because it seems that they're being given across the board.
But it could then be that 50% say of or 53% say of rhesus negative mothers who gave birth to rhesus positive babies, that could be the problem, rather than it being both blood groups. It could be one blood group specific. We don't really have enough information to ascertain whether that is true or not.
Which is, of course, the problem, really, that these distinctions just aren't being made. It is a significant difference, and I think the two arguments that I saw put across in the paper that was discussing this was, one was that the problem was being caused by in utero vaccination, with whatever the stuff is in the vaccine, and the other side of the argument seemed to be suggesting that the problems were arising directly from the rhesus negative mutation itself. Anybody's guess, really, but it does sound to me, because of course this argument that there seems to be some connection between childhood, some childhood vaccinations and autism, is something that's come up in other groups for several. I know that the measles, mumps and rubella vaccine, it came up, and the man was doing the research has been suitably demonized, which of course is as much likely to be proof that he's right as proof that he was wrong, in my opinion. But again, this is another, if you like, it, it's another, for me, it's another new manifestation of autistic spectrum disorders coming about, and being connected, at least by the people who have been having the vaccinations, with the problems.
I mean, my feeling really is that for rhesus negative women, because this affects rhesus negative women obviously much more than men, it would be nice if we had more information really about the blood group and about pregnancy and about the mixing of blood, and just some more information really about sort of what the practicalities are in terms of pregnancy. I mean, my daughter is rhesus negative. She has a rhesus positive husband, and she is in at the point of really being put off, of really being quite frightened of becoming pregnant, because she can't get the information that she requires to make an informed choice.
But the information that we're seeing here suggests that almost irrespective of how it goes, your first baby is probably going to be safe anyway, and there's only going to be any danger if there's a very unlikely mixing of blood. It doesn't sound like she should be getting information that makes her uncertain about it. I mean, it sounds to me like the kind of risk increases the more babies you have, but it sounds like first time round you should be able to at least have your first child. Isn't that right?
I mean, that is correct, but of course in terms of my mum's experience, it wasn't, because her first baby was stillborn. And I do know rhesus negative mothers who have had stillborn first babies, and the babies have been positive because of the antibodies that have built up. I mean, it can happen. But the other thing that you've got to bear in mind is that a lot of rhesus negative women may want to have a family, as in more than one child.
Yeah, indeed, and they might not like all the rhesus negative men. It seems, at least some people think, dangers associated with the Rogam shot as well. What the doctors never seem to admit or even talk about is the very, very real risk of putting these Rogam antibodies into the mother's bloodstream during gestation, because the Rh antibodies from the Rogam shot hang around in the mother's bloodstream for up to 12 weeks following the shot. And as a result, if any of the blood mixing does occur during that period of time, so if there is some kind of trauma or shock to the system or medical diagnosis or whatever, it is possible for some of the Rogam antibodies to find their way into the fetus bloodstream and attack them, causing the very Rh disease in the fetus that the shot is supposed to prevent. And we can quite see how that might be the case. There's also the possibility of side effects from the shot itself. Once again, the seeking out the active ingredients and putting plus side effects in gets some interesting results. But it includes swelling, inflammation, hives, and even anaphylactic shock are not out of the question. That's the shock that really gets to you very quickly. It's what some people get from eating peanuts or association with melon seeds, but it can come about as a result of many other things. You don't get much chance to resist anaphylactic shock either. Those are listed as side effects. And more concerning is that the Rh antibodies have the potential to negatively affect the immune response of either the mother or baby to other foreign substances that enter the bloodstream. So it's having clearly wider effects than simply dealing with the target that we're told it's endeavouring to hit. But that's, again, nothing new. As with any donated blood product, the Rogam shot also carries with it the possibility of bloodborne disease. Each Rogam shot contains the antibodies of several different donors pooled together, which increases the likelihood of viruses slipping through undetected to the Rogam recipient. And of course, we might add that it's certainly not unknown for the NHS to be giving dirty blood to people for 17 years or so, knowing they're doing it and still not stopping. It's virtually impossible to test and screen out all the various viruses that could be present in the donor blood. And once again, because we know that the motives behind many of these things is at least as much to make money as it is to make people better. And sometimes I think that it's simply to make money. But it's with Rogam and thimerosal, which is a name that many of you will have come across. It's one of the preservatives, I think, that they use in these things. And one of the most troubling aspects of Rogam could very well be the actual ingredients used. Like many vaccines, the shot used to contain thimerosal, which is an organomercury compound known to produce neurological damage, and this was supposedly phased out by 2001. One of the ladies that has done a lot of work on this and has actually come up with some of the more concentrated and interesting data just in easy to watch YouTube videos is called the Star Child 2009, and she recommends, like we always would, I guess, that you look pretty carefully at the contents of the thing that's going into you or into your baby and try and make sure that it doesn't have these things in it. And of course Rogam certainly wanted to reassure the public, I'm sure, as these sort of findings of autistic spectrum disorders and the rest started to arise, and so they at least appear to have done something about it. But apparently studies performed by the Health Advocacy in the Public Interest, HAPI, they're called, in 2004, oh my god, found that despite vaccine manufacturers' claims that thimerosal was no longer being used, in fact this 50% mercury-containing compound was still routinely included in the manufacturing process, with the thimerosal being filtered out of the final product. The problem is that the filtering process doesn't work very well. Mercury binds to the antigenic proteins and as such cannot be 100% removed. Filtered out afterwards. All vaccine vials tested by HAPI that were labelled mercury-free did in fact contain this neurotoxin. All the vials also contained aluminium, which enhances the toxicity of the mercury, causing rapid death of brain neurons. And I could be wrong, but I believe that the addition of the aluminium came about at about the same time as they were claiming to remove the thimerosal. So at the same time as maybe reducing the quantity of the one by the introduction of the other, they were actually increasing the effectiveness of whatever it was that was left to do damage. So is the Rogam shot now truly mercury or even aluminium free? Most likely not, but it seems now we're aware, are we not, people, that one of the frequent pieces of advice we're giving to people with regard to vaccines, and indeed all medicines and treatments that they're offered, is to look at the side effects that these things might cause. And one of the ways we can do this is by looking at the product insert labels. But it does seem, at least by some of the reports that I'm looking at, that these are now not always as reliable as they might be. Aware as we are that there's now sweeteners being put into things that are also neurotoxins that are defined in such a way that they no longer have to be labelled on the ingredients of the thing that they're in, this does not seem to be as unlikely and unfair as it might otherwise have done. It may even be quite common. But it used to be that Rogam was only given after an Rh-positive child was born. A newborn can easily be typed via cord blood, it says, if there was some birth intervention that made blood mixing a strong possibility, or if an accident or trauma occurred during pregnancy. However, it seems that the parental Rogam shots have become routine and arbitrary for all Rh-negative women, regardless of their partner's Rh status, and despite any pre-birth trauma or birth intervention. I wonder if there was anything special about that first pregnancy of your mum's that actually made the problem occur. Because it does sound like they're not really sort of expecting any trouble to occur with the first one, because the antibodies start building up thereafter. Like they say, though, why the change? Why has it become routine and arbitrary when we know that, at least in some cases, i.e. negative with negative parent will produce a negative child which won't have a problem? It seems to me that, once again, are we not just looking at the money?
Could I just say that even a negative mother with a positive partner who has a rhesus negative dormant gene can carry a rhesus negative baby quite happily and no problems.
Yeah, so long as the baby's negative and the mother's negative, how easy is it to test the baby's blood?
It would be much easier to test the father's blood. To be fair, I mean,
if he was positive, you'd have to know about.
You'd have to do a DNA test, of course, which we can do, can't we?
Yeah, it does seem mostly though that I mean, I think the thing with the blood tests and having people in there every week and stuff, it means you've got to get people into a crowded hospital. You've got to have manpower and machinery there to test it. You'd have to be sending all the blood out to the private corporations who do all the screening and the studying of it. And all of the time you'd be having to tell people that they couldn't come in for their appointment because something more important had turned up. So these things, I think, that are extremely resource hungry and require space for something that isn't going to necessarily make it. It's going to cost them cash and not make them cash, shall we say that? Well, is it not a lot more easy to just do a simple blood test and then anybody who's Rh negative gets this shot? And the conclusion of the of this particular item is that routine Rogam during pregnancy to all Rh negative mothers is simply a big pharma ploy to increase profits, not to protect babies from Rh disease. And hopefully it's already become clear from one or two things that we've said that if you are an Rh negative mother and you are pregnant, that there are certain things that you can have checked for yourself, which might mean that you can, even if, as is clearly the case, I mean, something perhaps can under some circumstances be helpful, but under some circumstances there's no way that it's going to be. And this is clearly one of those cases. And if you find yourself as an Rh negative mother and you're pregnant and your partner is Rh negative, then you can pretty safely turn down the Rogam shot. And there must be quite a lot of cases in which that happens. One of those points in which it'd be, I guess, useful to be just, to be self-informed. There is some advice in this article as well that follows on. If you are pregnant and Rh negative, the first question to consider is whether or not the father of your child is also Rh negative. If he is, then there is absolutely no need for the Rogam shot, period. There is no risk to your baby whatsoever. And of course it appears that there may be some risk to it if you do have the shot. If a doctor tries to convince you otherwise, he or she is wrong. In fact, getting a Rogam shot during pregnancy when both you and your partner are Rh negative endangers the life and the health of your child. Because getting a Rogam shot introduces Rh antibodies into your bloodstream, which could get into your baby's blood should some kind of physical trauma occur. This could give your baby Rh disease where it would be impossible otherwise without the shot. So these are important things to consider. And like I said, if you go out and have a look at what advice is being given to young mothers and the like, then it's not all at all clear. And one of the real problems is that it introduces fear and doubt at a time when fear and doubt are not necessarily helpful, because children, babies, fetuses are, I believe, extremely sensitive to the mother's emotional conditions, to the physical state she's in, and to all of those things. Real changes to the mother's mental state can make a fairly permanent impression on the child when it's born. I know that I read that the women that were present during the great disappearing of buildings in New York obviously suffered from raised cortisol levels, stress hormones and the like. And any of them that were in the third trimester of their pregnancy at the time gave birth to children who themselves had raised stress hormones right from the word go. So even actually introducing fear and doubt and uncertainty is unhelpful at this point. And it arises in two ways, because first of all, you're being offered a jab that you may or may not want. And the noise on vaccinations and injections and things is getting really quite loud now, and I think that many people are perhaps just made nervous by this and the need to find out. And the other way it can become a problem is when people do just say yes to having the Rogam shot, and then they have a look at the results afterwards and find out all of these things that might occur as a result. So the whole thing could do with being handled a little bit more carefully, and it does seem, as I suspected when I started looking into it, that at least under some circumstances, the job could be made a lot easier for the people concerned. If you are pregnant and Rh negative with an Rh positive partner, you should also decline a routine Rogam shot during pregnancy for the same exact reasons, which is more or less what you were saying, wasn't it, Jill? There is no protection to the current baby you are carrying from the Rogam shot while you are still pregnant. It is an arbitrary and useless shot during gestation unless you are in a car wreck or have some other trauma happen. The final question is whether or not you should have the Rogam shot after the birth of the child. If you are Rh negative with an Rh negative father, the answer is once again a resounding no. There is still a chance. Yes, there we go. If you are Rh negative with an Rh positive partner, Rogam after birth might be called for if you were induced, had an epidural, C-section, or other birth intervention, all of which, of course, could possibly lead to the blood mixing, which causes the problem in the first place, and would greatly increase the chances of blood mixing between the mother and the baby. There is still a chance, as Jill said, that your baby's Rh negative, even if your partner is Rh positive. So always have the baby's cord blood typed after birth, if you're considering Rogam, after an interventionist birth, to determine if it's even of any potential value. Am I missing something here? Why would you want to have the this injection after the birth? Is it perhaps to keep the antibodies down in case you're going to have another baby? Yeah, that must be what it is. Likelihood that Rogam still has a neurotoxic preservative such as thimerosal and or aluminium, despite labelling claims to the contrary, make taking the shot under any circumstances a decision worth questioning. If you had a natural birth with no induction or intervention of any kind, where the placenta was permitted to detach naturally from the uterus, then Rogam after birth is clearly unnecessary. There are also some natural ways of preventing the mixing between the mother and the fetus, which seems to be the basis of the problem. Here we go. Red raspberry and nettle tea throughout pregnancy, and especially during the last trimester, helps to tone the uterus and keep it strong, reducing the chance of any blood mixing during the actual birth process. In addition, ensuring that no fluoridated water or non-organic tea, which is itself high in fluoride, especially green tea, are consumed during pregnancy is wise as fluoride has been shown to interfere with collagen production, and the placenta attaches firmly to the uterus via collagen fibers. As always, a healthy pregnancy diet is extremely protective in preventing any blood mixing. Something else, of course, that you won't necessarily hear from the health service. I don't think they're allowed to tell us that a healthy diet is important, let alone vital. Yeah, and then it says that the author's mother, Rh negative mother and positive father, delivered healthy Rh positive children with no Rogam shots by simply eating healthy and having natural births. So the actual shot seems to be a thing which at least a lot of people could make fairly easy decisions about. It still leaves us though with this, I can't help feeling, my feeling is that with the removal of the blood group types from the GP surgeries, with the fact that Rh negative people are no longer being given green cards, my instinct is, and has been since I heard about this, that something is being hidden, something's not being made clear.
I agree. I think it, to me, there is less information now than there was when I was a teenager, and I just find that crazy. And there's people out on the street that have got rhesus negative blood who've got no idea that is so, and I just find that very strange, especially these implications on childbirth, which we've gone through at length. And the other thing I find strange is the fact that nobody has given me any good reason or argument as to why we've got this blood group, why we've got this discrepancy, why there is this sort of small proportion of rhesus negative people on the planet. I just find that that's fascinating, but I would love to know why that is so.
And of course, one of the things you came across recently, and really, we've been talking about rhesus negative blood for some time on the show, but one of the things that really decided us to do it now was that last weekend Jill decided to reply to an advert in National Geographic magazine for a thing called the Genographic Project 2.0 Beta. By the kit, it says. Let me just expand this so that I can see it properly. It says, Geno 2.0, Genographic Project Participation and DNA Ancestry Kit. It's from the National Geographic, making a big thing of it. This holiday season, celebrate your family's past, present and future with a Genographic Project Participation Kit. This new DNA test uses cutting-edge technology to bring you the richest ancestry information available. You'll learn about your own family journey while contributing to a real-time science project. It's a mere $199.95, but a generous person was offering Jill a Christmas present for the year, so she decided she'd give it a go, didn't you, Jill? What happened?
Well, I thought this might provide an answer. You know, have I got ancient sort of Jewish roots? Have I got ancient Basque roots? Where does this rhesus negative gene come from? I know, if I buy this kit, perhaps I'll discover it somewhere. Anyway, I went online, I put the kit in the cart, as they call it in America, and clicked on the payment section. And even though there is nothing wrong with my card, I have used my card many, many times before, it was declined on at least four or five occasions. And I thought, strange, no idea why. And then my mobile telephone rang at the same time as the landline, and a voice on the end of the telephone said it was a fraud squad. And they didn't ask me questions, they gave me the answers to questions, and then asked me whether the answers were correct.
So what sort of stuff were they asking you and giving you the answers to then?
I can't tell you.
So they were telling you what your mother's maiden name was, weren't they?
Yeah, it's like, what's your, like, mother's maiden name, where did your parents meet, and things which were unusual. I wasn't expecting the answers to the questions. Normally if you have to verify who you are, they normally ask you the questions and then you give the answers. But this was sort of the reversal of that, followed by, yes, madam, that's fine, you can use your card now. However, I could not use it to purchase this kit.
So the credit card's still working, is it?
Correct.
So I'm pretty puzzled by that. I've posted the address for this kit into both of the chat boxes because I'm a bit puzzled as to, I might consider the fact that Jill had tried to use this perfectly valid card three or four times on the internet enough to actually wake up a fraud squad to go, hey, look, there's somebody trying to use a credit card four times. They're obviously failing. Perhaps we should check them out. Did they actually say they were the fraud squad?
Yeah,
they said they were the fraud squad. Do you know where they came from? Do you know?
No.
You no idea who they were. No. And instead of asking questions like what's your mother's maiden name and where did your mum meet your dad and stuff like that, they actually asked the questions by saying, are you Gillian blah, what is your mother's maiden name blah, and did they live at so and so. So they're asking questions and giving you the answers, claiming to be the fraud squad. Then they told you that you could use your credit card, but basically it turns out you can't use it to buy the gene testing kit. I find it very difficult. I can imagine many things that are going on there, but none of them are particularly credible. It just doesn't bear thinking about that, that, you know, your rhesus neg blood type's being kept a tab on to the point where they're not going to let you buy a gene testing kit. But it would be interesting to know if any other rhesus negatives are interested in looking into this kind of thing, whether they have similar problems. I've also suggested to Jill that she tries to get somebody else who's rhesus negative to buy the kit, to see whether they get the same response, and after that we'll perhaps try and get somebody who's rhesus positive to buy the kit and see whether, because there's something very odd going on there. But you obviously your credit card had been interfered with, you'd had a bit of an unsatisfactory time shopping on the internet, which I know is so rare, but you decided to phone Barclays up, didn't you, your bank, the next day?
Yeah, I phoned Barclays the next day and just to check. I was so stunned because often you do make a mistake when you type in a number or whatever, but you don't normally have a fraud squad phone call. This is my first experience really of such a phone call. So I telephoned the bank the next day just to verify that this had happened, and they said yes, I've no need to talk to the bank anymore. The card was fine and I could use it.
you go back and try and buy the kit again?
It doesn't work.
There you go. So we will actually continue experiments into that. I'm going to look a lot further into some of the deeper scientific stuff that I've found on this, although it is extremely scarce and far between. I think that more looking into this is definitely called for. I'm sure that me and Jill will continue to share some links on it. Blood types that apparently in human beings that are certainly carrying an extra vertebrae, certainly carrying copper-based blood, which in all likelihood is immune to HIV, and may indeed also not be clonable. That's something else that it's not clonable, so you can't clone rhesus negative people either. So I hope that some of that information has been helpful as well. I hope that we've cleared up a few things. There's a little bit more information out there. If I come across anything interesting, I'll get back to you with it when that occurs. But in the meantime, I shall play a couple of tunes, get back to you before the end of the show, and say thank you very much to Jill for coming in and sharing your experience.
Thanks very much. You're welcome.
That was a recording of an interview for Dr. Rock's radio show, first broadcast on Thursday the 13th of December 2012. I had hoped during that show to be able to talk to a young rhesus negative mother about how the NHS deals with people currently when this subject arises, but it didn't prove to be possible. I did, however, catch up with Sophie for the following week's show, broadcast on the 20th of December, and what follows is a short conversation that I had with her about her experience of giving birth just a few weeks ago. There's also a bit of a reprise of some of the information covered in the earlier show, and a little bit more detail on the potential for rhesus negative blood types to be resistant to or sometimes immune to the HIV/AIDS virus. So this is Sophie from 20th of December 2012. Return just briefly to a topic that I was looking at in some detail last week, which is the presence of and the effect of rhesus negative bloodlines in the population and how it is that the medical system deals with these. The basic thing, just to sum it up, is that rhesus negative is a particular bloodline. If a rhesus positive baby arises, then if the blood between the rhesus negative mother and the rhesus positive baby mixes at any point, then the mother's body starts building up antibodies, just as if it had had an organ transplanted that was not original to it, and it endeavours to get rid of the baby. Well, we learned last week that the actual risk of this blood mixing is pretty tiny, really, and is put down. It occurs apparently largely when traumatic incidents such as car crashes occur. However, it was also pointed out that several of the diagnostic techniques that are used, such as amniocentesis and one or two others, as well as in utero injections, can actually cause the mixing of the blood that the diagnostic technique or injections are designed to mitigate. So the solution to all of this, to the building up of antibodies in the mother's blood and everything, has been, as we might expect, rather tiresomely the creation of an injection, a vaccine, or it's a globulin, which is designed to prevent the mother's body from building up the antibodies that it will otherwise build. Now, we realize that under some circumstances, there is definitely absolutely no need for this injection, because if both parts of the couple, if the man and the lady are both rhesus negative, then inevitably there will be a rhesus negative child, and as such, the mixing of the blood will not be a problem. And yet we discovered that although women quite often, though not always it appears, find out that they're rhesus negative when they first become pregnant, it's not the habit of the health service to then test the blood of the male partner to find out whether any of these interventions are necessary. And it appeared last week that there might be a tendency for these injections to be recommended somewhat willy-nilly. I was hoping to have Sophie on the show last week, but she was too busy up the hill, because she's just experienced having a baby, and as a rhesus negative mother, we can hear the first-hand story of what happened to her. I'll let her tell her tale, and then if any questions arise either in the chat box or to me, I'll ask them afterwards. So thanks for joining us again, Sophie. You may also hear Ivy in the background, because she's in here as well.
Thank you. Okay, so I suppose it all started really, I got pregnant before having Ivy. I started off, I didn't realise I was recess negative at all. I thought I just had a regular blood group. And the first time round, I was never told what blood group I had and wasn't given any anti-D or anything like that. But unfortunately, I got to 7 weeks pregnant and the baby, I had a miscarriage. But it wasn't like a normal miscarriage. It was just the gestational sac was left and the embryo wasn't there anymore. And I actually went on to 12 weeks before I actually realised this, and my body carried on thinking that it was pregnant. And then I got pregnant again a year afterwards. And the same thing happened again, but this time I'd found out that I was resus negative, and they'd given me the anti-D and everything like that, without my consent, yeah. So, basically I had to have an operation to have it all removed, the gestational sac and such, the second time round, and they just gave the anti-D, in theatre, so I didn't actually know what was going on. And then, I got pregnant again with Ivy and she, you know, it grew and she was fine. And during my pregnancy with Ivy, I was offered the anti-D halfway through the pregnancy, which I thought was, you know, strange. And whenever I ask questions about the anti-D injection as well, the midwife never really knew much about it. I was always just given leaflets and, you know, and no one really seems to know much about this anti-D injection and what, you know, the effects, potential effects it could have on the baby whilst you're pregnant, which is slightly worrying. I did take it anyway because the whole fear thing in pregnancy, and it is really pushed on you, and they were saying, you know, if you don't have it, then it could potentially, if you were to get pregnant again, you could potentially, you know, reject the baby, which obviously I didn't want to happen. And then when I had Ivy, I was given the anti-D again, after I'd had her. When I had Ivy as well, she had positive blood. So I did have to have this anti-D injection. Also that to find out her blood, obviously they had to take it from the placenta. But I opted for a completely natural birth. So a completely natural, for the placenta to come out naturally. So I had to wait, but unfortunately it was taking a while to come out, and they wanted to intervene and give me this injection to expel it, so they could take the blood from the placenta to test to see if Ivy's blood group was positive or not. And they were threatening if I didn't have this injection to expel the placenta, they would actually bleed the baby, which I really didn't want. So I was like, right, okay, just give me the injection, which then led to, you know, hemorrhaging, and I ended up having to have a blood transfusion and going into theatre. So it was all quite messy in the end because of this injection. No, this wasn't the anti-D injection. Sorry, this injection was to expel the placenta. I'm not 100% sure what it is. I know that it's quite common for women to just have it straight away. They just, if you have a hospital birth, it's standard practice for them to just inject you with this drug. It's straight in the thigh. As soon as the baby's born, it's straight in the thigh, and then it expels your placenta, so it's not done naturally anymore. You have to actually write it down on your notes that you don't want it, because otherwise they'll just do it, like, you know. and I'm not quite sure what it is and what it's about.
So did they test Dan's blood at all?
No, they never actually asked to test his blood, and they never actually asked his bug group once. You know, and because, to be honest, I don't really know much about the whole recess negative thing. As I said, when I've asked questions about it, the midwife never really seemed to know. She just passed me on to a leaflet, which, you know, they don't really explain a lot, the leaflets that they give you. And so I wasn't 100% sure. I had to do my own research, really, to find out more about, you know, what in the anti-D, yeah. So in the anti-D in America, they put the mercury, they put all these nasties in it. And luckily in England, if you can call it lucky, I'm not sure, they don't actually put the mercury and stuff in it. It's kept in the freezer to preserve it and stuff. So there's less nasties in it, hopefully. but yeah.
It sounds like that sounds like a whole run of really difficult decisions to have had to make with very little actual information from the people who are requiring you to make the decisions.
Yeah. Basically, well, that's just what tends to happen, I think, to most women during pregnancy nowadays. I didn't know that I had recess negative blood until a lot later on in my life, like when I got pregnant the second time round. So I wasn't sure, you know, what was going on really, and you know, what in it entailed and stuff. So,
well, thanks very much for that personal story, because I was keen to talk to a young mother about what was going on at the moment, because there's several things that strike me as a little odd about it. The first is that you weren't tested when you first had a baby.
No.
And the second baby was lost at about the same point as the first one, at exactly the same point at 7 weeks. See, this is another thing I find interesting, because actually, to my amazement, we're absolutely surrounded by rhesus negative people for a start off, which is interesting. But I'm told that you are likely to find them in alternative lifestyles, because as we heard last week, they don't take too well necessarily to the everyday social world and feel a little bit apart from it. But typically we thought that people were having their blood tested when they had the first baby. That's when they seem to be finding out. Of course, in the old days, your blood type would have been held by your GP on a record and it would have been easy, but it's one of those things that's disappeared. You've confirmed for us effectively the fact that, as on the anti-D website I was looking at, that it seems to be given at 26 and 36 weeks, which is, yeah, that's right. So that's well into the pregnancy and then again afterwards. And yet one of the things I found on a couple of websites that were a critical reviews, if you like, of the Rogam shot, is that it only does its business if it's injected 72 hours, within 72 hours of any blood mixing occurring. So it seems a bit strange on that basis to just be giving two out to all rhesus negative women. Also, of course, we found out by listening to you that Dan's blood wasn't tested. Now, on this occasion, it wouldn't have made any odds, because he's obviously rhesus positive, because you've got a rhesus positive child. But of course, once again, if they were looking at genuinely kind of limiting the amount of stuff they're pumping into you rather than kind of enhancing it, then that's a simple test that could have been done. So all of that's quite interesting. I'm sure you'll be looking more into the rhesus negative, won't you? I'm looking more detail into the information that I'd received last week, and I've received a bit more, actually a few more links. I'd actually like to talk to somebody in the medical profession, such as it is, who has got some knowledge of this, because the ones I've spoken to, who are working in hospitals and the like, seem to have about the same level of knowledge as you do about it. And of course, one of the things that attracted me to this subject in the first place is that actually it's very difficult to find information. Have you found that?
Yeah, I did try and look up online, and, you know, just ask around and stuff. And yeah, there's nothing out there really. information-wise about it. It's all the same, like I said, these NHS leaflets that just tell you the same thing about that, you know, that they have to have anti-D, what pregnant women have to have anti-D to, in order to, you know, produce these what normal pregnant women wouldn't produce these antibodies, and it's to help not produce these antibodies. So yeah, that there's not a lot out there really, so I would be interested to look into it if you find anything.
The same for anybody out there, of course. If any of you have got any particular experiences or good links on rhesus negative, I'd really like to see them. Because of course there are wider interests as well, because one of the things we found out last week is that this blood is definitely copper based, whereas everybody else's blood is iron based, which is pretty interesting. We learned also that some people were claiming that rhesus negative individuals are immune to AIDS, and my ever watchful webmaster Mick the Moon, who keeps an eye on all of the blogs I put out for this show and on everything that I put up for the talks and things, and if he spots something that he thinks is not quite correct, then he will let me know instantly and in no uncertain terms. And very grateful I am for the service he offers me in that, because I'm not a scientist, I'm certainly not an astronomer, and so sometimes I don't always understand the things I'm reading, and it's great to know there's somebody out there keeping an eye on me. And one of the things he sent back to me as soon as I sent out last week's blog was that he was pretty sure that some rhesus negative people do have HIV/AIDS. And I had actually looked at this a little bit before last week's show, but then forgot to mention it. But it does turn out that it would appear that rhesus negatives, along with a couple of the normal blood groups, have resistance to HIV/AIDS. But it looks like this arises as a result of a separate mutation of a gene. And that's of course implying that the rhesus negative is a mutation, which it might not be. It might be the original stock. But anyway, this alternative mutation yields resistance to HIV/AIDS if you get it from one parent. But if you get two copies of it, so if it comes across from both of the parents, then you end up being immune to HIV/AIDS. And it would appear that, at least from my reading at the moment, and I've got to do a bit more on it, that this particular mutative gene, the one that yields what is after all apparently protection to a man-made virus, is more common in rhesus negative people and much more common in certain localized populations, because that's another thing we noticed about the rhesus negative, is that they're especially concentrated in various populations around the world. So it does seem that that a combination of the rhesus negative and this mutative factor, whatever it is, can yield immunity to what, I don't know whether everybody believes this now, but what I certainly believe is a man-made virus actually targeted at various people. And if you're going to target the virus, then you can also make sure that some people are definitely not targets. So again, very interesting thing. I'm sure we'll be able to find out more stuff about that as time goes on. I feel the impetus for investigation into that is increasing. And as I say, I'm absolutely stunned just wandering around the place asking people whether they're rhesus negative or not, how many people actually are out here on the raggedy edge.